Welcome to the Yokoji Zen Mountain Center podcast. Every month, we share at least one new talk on the practice of Zen Buddhism at zmc.org/podcast. You can also find us on iTunes, Spotify, and all other podcast apps. If you find these talks to be valuable, please consider supporting Yokoji by donating at zmc.org/donate. We rely on your support to continue sharing this life-changing practice. Thank you. We hope you enjoy the talk.
Good morning. Hope you're all doing well. Just have to start off with a logistics thing, is that we've got passing thunderstorms, so at some point we may have to unplug things. So don't take it personally if that's the case. It'll be fairly quick if that occurs. So today I wanted to talk about a koan that addresses quite a bit of Zen practice, and I want to riff off this basically. So this is case six of the Book of Equanimity. So this is Shishin's commentaries in this, and this is Kyuho's Head and Tail. Preface to the Assembly. Those with supernatural power and marvelous activity can't step in. Those who have forgotten externals and eliminated thoughts still can't lift up a foot. Let's say sometimes there are running dead and sometimes there are sitting dead. How can they be made complete? The main case. Attention! A monk asked Kyuho, "What is the head?" Kyuho said, "Opening the eyes and not being aware of the dawn." The monk asked, "What is the tail?" Kyuho said, "Not sitting on an eternal seat." The monk asked, "What about having the head and no tail?" Kyuho said, "After all, it's not precious." The monk asked, "What about having a tail and no head?" Kyuho said, "Though satisfied, you are powerless." The monk asked, "How about when head and tail are directly well matched?" Kyuho replied, "A descendant gains power without knowing it." The appreciatory verse. A compass for a circle, a ruler for the square. With use it functions well, with neglect it hides. Stupid and bumbling, a bird dwelling in the reeds. Backing and filling, sheep caught in a fence. Eating others' food, sleeping in one's own bed. Clouds rise and rain falls. Dew collects and turns to frost. The well-aligned jewel string passes through the needle's eye. The embroidered thread unceasingly vomits from the shuttle's guts. A stone woman stops weaving and night's colors turn towards noon. A wooden man travels the road and the moon silhouette moves to half full. So I mean there's a lot in the poem itself, but this really is addressing certain concerns that people have about Buddhist practice. Zen practice obviously is included in that, because there's criticisms that have been made about Buddhism right from the beginning. You know, some people say it's quietistic. You know, it doesn't involve much in the way of action. It's really about meditation, which is, people say, is selfish in that respect. There's also other things about taking practice into daily life. And I know this is an issue because people say this, you know, over and over, and have done since Maizumi Roshi was alive. So, you know, my contact with him started in 79 and ended with his physical passing in 95. But those questions still go on. you know, is that, well, you know, how does practice affect basically your daily life? Not only once or twice, but, you know, on a momentary basis. For anyone that gets onto the path of Zen or Jhana, meditation, Jhana, which means reflecting basically, or quiet reflecting on one's life. How does that really permeate? You know, you could say right from the beginning that we are consciousness. It doesn't matter whether you practice or not. You know, the functioning of this one has been put into place right from the beginning. It's never been any different than this. You know, ever since consciousness first arose, there was a time where I was alive, but consciousness hadn't really gelled. It hadn't come into being. And that unknowing or not knowing has been there right since the beginning. It's flowed underneath that aspect of consciousness, which, again, never ceases to function 24/7, no matter where, no matter who. And so then there are images of images or narratives of Zen, is that, you know, people that live in centers sit around on their butts all day. You know, that's one image. I remember there was this lady that came to help us with some fundraising. She stayed with us for a little while, and she goes, "Well, how can we get people to donate? You know, if you're sitting all the time." And I went, "How did these buildings appear?" You know, she's like, you know, how do they get maintained? How's the cleaning going on, etc.? But again, we have to look at these questions, because some people think that there are two separate things going on. There's meditation and there's living or life. If you look at it from the standpoint of consciousness, it doesn't really matter, you know. How, if the meat puppet is still or the meat puppet is moving in all different ways, you know, it really doesn't make much difference at all from that perspective. When I was studying with Maizumi Roshi, as soon as, you know, I so-called got good with meditation, then there was the process then of taking care of the center and taking care of the people that were there. And all of that was done in the spirit of Zen in activity. You know, Master Hakuin would say, "What is more efficacious than basically Zen in everyday life, where the person works on whatever their inner work is in all kinds of circumstances, so that." You know, basically, it really doesn't matter what you are, again, because that consciousness is functioning on a momentary basis. And then people will say, "Well, you know, how can you carry this?" Sometimes they'll say emptiness into daily life. Well, you don't carry anything there. Emptiness basically is that what you're moving into is not a fixed thing. Is that the mind corresponds with whatever circumstances is there in front of you. It's not meant to be a certain way. It's not meant to be quietistic. It's not meant to be full of fuzzy activity that the mind tends to generate whenever it's in something that is difficult. You know, the thing is, how do I meet the challenge of whatever arises in living? And then have that yes mind, which is, you know, I can do it in one way or another, which is very important. If you think you can't do it, it won't be done. If you think you can, then you find a way and help that to go through. So here, you know, Kyuho's talking about these parts of practice. So for myself, is whenever I think of this, you know, Kyuho and his head and tail, I think of, you know, something like a Tyrannosaur out of Jurassic Park. It's got a big head and it's got this huge fat tail on the back end, which balances it. And that's important. You know, it balances it. It's not like the tyrannosaurs when I was a kid where the tail was dragging in the dirt and the head was like sticking way up on the top. No, they're a balance, these things. You know, just like our lives are a natural balance. They may not feel like they're in balance, but, you know, again, is to find balance, you've got to go to the extremes and see what's actually going on there. So you've got a head and a tail. So basically, you can say with this is the head is realization. You know, and that's great. In Zen, we really value this. You know, we value this realization. A lot of others don't talk about it. You know, but Christian mysticism definitely talk about, you know, these things. But is that really valuable to people? I don't often talk about, you know, realizations that I have, because it can be really damaging to the person. They can start going, well, oh, I want that, and then I'm going to aim towards that. And then it becomes a thing. But everybody's realization is different. It's like, I remember when they brought out the three pillars of Zen. It had all of these enlightenment experiences of people. And it's like, oh, that's great. You know, it's really good, and it's like something to attain, something to have. I remember my Zumi Roshi saying, "Yeah, don't read about that stuff, because for you it's going to be different." And sure enough, for myself, yeah, that was the most important thing, was having that realization for myself, and then obviously not remaining there, not getting stuck in that way. In the opening. Introduction or preface to the assembly, it says, those with supernatural power and marvelous activity can't step in. So don't think that a teacher knows who you are and where you are. They may know some ballpark things, but everybody's own consciousness cannot be gauged by other. You know, you have to have that experience for yourself, and a teacher can't look at that. They might be able to help and point out certain patterns, but those are the parts where the traces are. Those are the things that are pointed to. With a few questions, usually you can see where a person is standing, but the depth of that consciousness is equal to all of the Buddhas of the past. You know, this is one of the difficulties that we have. You know, maybe you will say, well, so-and-so is a genius. They're really good in that way, but that's irrelevant. Your own mind has this encompassing aspect that has been there since the beginning. It's unfathomable in that respect. I mean, just look at the I don't mean just children, but look at a kid and the consciousness. It encompasses everything right from the beginning. You know, it may not have developed in terms of the working, in terms of its environment, but that just is a matter of time. And it's the same with each one of us. Basically, if you keep at it, it's just a matter of time. Master Dogen would say, you know, right from the beginning, you have this mind of realization. So have faith in yourself, and then what happens is that by having that faith in, you begin to use the opportunities that are available to you in whatever lifestyle that you've chosen to do. But the important thing is the desire for awakening, to be awake. And that sometimes is very simple. It isn't even in a religious context. I remember when I first started practice, I left university, not because of practice, but, you know, I wanted to be a carpenter. I wanted to do that. It was something that was kind of in my DNA, I guess. Seems my father and my grandfather were that way. And so it was my mother decided that you've got to go to, you know, to do City and Guilds. So I was about 19, and most of the kids in there were about 16. And so I decided that I'm not going to take a 19-year-old's view of the 16-year-olds and whatever was being taught. I decided... I'm going to be awake and aware to whatever comes up in that place. So I did my unusual thing, which was I sat near the front. Usually I sit at the back, you know, with the hecklers. And so I, you know, I, I did that, and then at the same time, I was also practicing not sleeping as much. So I was seeing how my mind functioned under not sleeping so much. So I really vowed to be awake in these things and whatever I did. And that really brought other parts of my mind awake that normally wouldn't be awake in that way. And it's as simple as that, is that do I want to be in the wake? Do I want to be awake in the midst of this, of whatever is going on? And then to engage then with the rest of life, which is the important thing, is that there is realization and there is engaging wherever you are. It's not a shutting down. I have a realization and then now I've got it and I can just get on with things. It's the awakening includes your environment too, the people around you. Just in the same way that Shakyamuni Buddha, when he was awakened, then he made the vow to himself that I'm gonna try and teach other people this because it's really valuable. This really helps, this really helps in terms of my own being in that way. And he didn't feel separate from the people around him. And he made that attempt. You know, don't think that he was successful all the time. No, he wasn't. And it matured him as a human being. And it also helped the people that were around him just by making that attempt. And that's really important. And that's the tale. That's the function in. You know, in his case, it was teaching. It was in his case, it was ministering to the people that were around him. But part of that ministering was seeing, well, okay, we've been in this area now for long enough. These people are beginning to struggle with keeping, you know, giving us food, etc., and shelter in some cases. So then they would migrate to another area. And so that was also part of the practice in that way. Coming back to the functioning is that, you know, we do function and take it as an opportunity. That's the important part of it. Even if it's in an unknown way, how can I be awake and aware? And that's as simple as that. How can I do it? Rather than, well, a person who has my realization shouldn't be doing such and such. You know, that's bullshit. The important thing here is that, you know, I'm alive. This is awakening in itself. How can it be taken into all these different activities? So now I'll go into the koan in a more, basically line by line. So a monk asked Kyuho, so what is the head? And so he actually directly says it. He says about realization. He goes, opening the eyes and not being aware of the dawn. So at some, and this is not you you should be not aware of the dawn. This is the criteria don't make any matter at this point. There is nobody home in that way. That doesn't mean there is an absence. It means anything can fill that space. Anything can fill that space. So rather than having one story running all the time about how things should be, what we think religion is or what we think practice is that you're open to this world. Nothing gets in the way at that point. Because opening the eyes and not being aware of the door. And some of you will recognize that. But that's his expression. You know? So what to do with that core? Now, if that is the case, then it becomes a lot easier to deal with people because you're not run by your narrative. This is who I am. This is what I like. This is what I dislike. This is where I'm going. This is where I've been. A person like me shouldn't fill in the blank, you know, in whatever way. None of that is operating. This is consciousness. What to do with it? And you really see that bottom line of consciousness is, again, functioning 24/7, whether we like it or not. This is such a great realization in that way because you no longer need a story, a narrative. I remember when that narrative disappeared for me for the first time. It scared the crap out of me. You know, it's just like, whoa. My life is not based on anything. But then later there was a true realization where there is no fear based around it. There is just this. And this occurs impersonally, again, since beginningless time. So what do you do with that? The monk, I like the monk because he's really precocious. You know, he has some really good insight. And then the monk says, what is the tale? You know, so now you've got the balancing part. He goes, we're not sitting on an eternal seat. Now, you know, a lot of people come to the center and they think it's going to be ease and bliss from then on out, you know. But that's not the case. You know, you may have realization, but then there are all kinds of things to enter into and to test one's practice with whatever it is that you're doing, whether you like it or not. And that's also important. Can't always be on your own, in your own criteria. I mean, obviously this happens in everybody's life anyway, but how do you really use this and use whatever support systems are there? So, you know, is that we are faced with challenges, and the important thing is, okay, then how do I, you know, common question, how do I take this practice into this? And the important thing here, don't be put down by failure. I failed so many times, I don't know. But the important thing is don't let it knock you down. Get up again. Try. Apply it. Try. Until at some point is that, you know, fame and gain, success, failure, they're irrelevant. The one who sees through these eyes, hears through these ears, is functioning 24/7. And you cannot be taken away from that no matter what you do. Now, one of the beauties of this is this also attacks a current view of meditation, is that now I am being aware of this, you know, this object over here. That's not it. You know, with our own consciousness, we embody our environment, and it's just entering into and being our environment over and over. The environment may be the people around us. It may be a job that we're doing. But it's not holding on to an objective thing. It is losing oneself in whatever occurs, again, on a momentary basis. This is where true art comes, where there's nothing left over. There's not somebody watching something else. There's the immersion in painting, in cooking, in carpentry, in doing a roof, whatever. It's that everything is put into this, you know, computer work. There's just that, you know, constant absorption in whatever's going on, until there's no need to hold on to a specific state of mind. I mean, you look at your own consciousness and how it adapts. You know, so for instance, if I'm talking with somebody that's lived a long time, then I naturally go into that mode and talk with them from that level. If I talk with a kid, then I go into that kid mind. It's not that I am fixed as something. The mind goes into the mind of the kid. When something needs to be protected, then the protector comes in, and that comes in, and then that goes away. Then it's immersing it maybe in something that I really enjoy. The mind just naturally corresponds to that. And it's also not a matter of size. Sometimes I'm repairing something that's really small. The mind goes small into that, to deal with that. Maybe then there's enjoying the sunset or the cloudscape. The mind naturally goes very broad. You can't even tie down this consciousness. You can't say, well, Zen is this, or Zen is that, or meditation is this or that. Meditation is exactly what we're going through at any given moment. We cannot escape our own consciousness, or you could say our own self. And when I say self, I don't mean the story that goes around it. I mean the direct experience of consciousness in whatever's going on. Then we have to work with all the things. Well, I would like it to be like this, or I would like it to be like that. Disabuse yourself of that right away. It is the way it is. And that's the beauty. That's the tale. That's the functioning that's always going on. And so, you know, the monk has some very valid questions. So he goes on. He says this one, not sitting on eternal seat. There is no one thing. That, again, applies all around. What about having the head and no tail? So, again, is that with many teachers and centers, they have this thing where they value this realization, and a certain arrogance develops in that way. You know, I'm realized, so-and-so is realized, they have this, and they have that, you know. And I just remember with Mayuzumi Roshi, he didn't have that, you know, that preciousness around him. What were you doing, Roshi, talking with those guys? You go, oh, we're just telling dirty jokes, you know. And again, it's just like, you know, it's just like whatever they were, you know, for a Japanese guy. And so, you know, the mind is like this. How do we use it? How do we function with it? Are we afraid of our own mind? That isn't realization. Are we afraid of being the lowest of the low? Do we get puffed up by being the highest of the high? You know, this is all Zen practice when we're in those situations. Mayuzumi Roshi used to use that all the time. You know, it's like it'd promote you and then it'd go, oh, well, so-and-so's going to do that now. Then it'd demote you. You know, but in time is that through really seeing and knowing who you are, didn't matter. You know, really didn't matter where those things occurred or how. Okay, so what about having the head and no tail? And he goes, after all, it's not precious. You know, that's beautiful. It's not precious. You know, so how can you say that? You know, the Buddha said, all beings have the wisdom and virtue of the awakened one to thusness. But that's the first thing he said in terms of his teaching. This is the very koan of Buddhism. All beings have that. Do we treat them in that way, all beings? Or is the those that have, those that don't have? Is it these people have the knowledge and these people don't? Or is it seeing people as oneself wherever you are in that way? Once I was driving with Mayuzumi Roshi and a Theravada monk in Kentucky, where, you know, where there's the floods. You know, I set out my prayers for those guys right now. But we were going off to a Trappist monastery there where Thomas Merton was. And the Theravada monk was going, oh, we better stop to eat because I can't eat after 12. And Mayuzumi Roshi was going, don't be so precious. Don't be so precious. You can eat later. He goes, oh, I can't. Okay. Well, don't eat then. You know, it's just, there's this thing is where the actual everybody moving forward in whatever way is far more important than an individual thing. If you can't put that on one side, that should be looked at. There is the common good. You know, that goes through Buddhism. It's not about being the top of the food chain and people supporting you in that way. It's got to be in both ways. You know, you have to support sometimes. People have to support you sometimes. But a lot of this is being that integrated aspect of the head and the tail. It goes on. So after that nice question, after all, it's not precious. Monk asks, what about having the tail and no head? Though satisfied, you're powerless. And we also see this in Zen too. You know, people will wear the robes and they'll do the stuff. You know, he's kind of dead. And but there's no spirit in there. They'll function. Oh, I'm going to enter into this. I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. They do it, but there's no core. That core really isn't there. The spirit that can function in no matter what, no matter where. And then quite often those people just get burnt out because they think the function is the important thing without the realization that goes behind it. You know, the classic case is that I think back in the 60s, there was a famine in Africa and some bright spark in the government said, well, why don't we give them tractors? And they'll be able to, you know, plow the fields and make food. So they gave them the tractors, and then the tractors ran out of gas, and they stayed as lawn ornaments. And again, this is that thing, is that having the tail but no head. There's no empathy, there's no feeling for those people. Is that first see how these things function, you know, and then begin to act in accord with those things. So he goes, though satisfied, you're powerless. And you will see this over and over. People quite often become satisfied with the forms, but there's no spirit there. That's the thing that is brought to light. And don't think it's an either or with these things. There's shades in this too. We all have our ways that we function. And again, is the consciousness in itself is a way cutting through things that get in the way in that way, and seeing how our life functions, and then making the changes that are necessary. So he goes on, and how about when the head and tail are directly well matched? Kyuho said, a descendant gains power without knowing it. And now this is one of the beauties of Zen practice, is that you put yourself into it and you do it over and over. It's a practice. It's not a thing about becoming a teacher at the end. I'm still a practitioner. I'm still learning in that way. I teach as an aside. I try and set an example. I'm not the greatest of examples in that way. But the thing is that you find yourself functioning. You find yourself with that realization. You find yourself doing the things that the ancestors have done. And it's natural to you at that point, whether you're in the center or you're outside in the world. It just gets embodied in you. And it's not a matter of, well, now I'm this, therefore I can do that. It's just like, oh, you know, the training wheels have come off, and it's, you know, there I am. I'm riding the bike. It's working. There's that function. That's the most natural way. A lot of people want to do, well, I want to do this curriculum. I want to fill it up. And then when I've done, then I'll become a teacher. That's fine. You know, some people do that in about 2 years. Well, what's wrong with that? If you have the head and the tail, there's no problem with that. You know, people come to me and go, well, I'm a teacher, you know, of whatever thing. And they go, well, so what? You know, can you function? I've not seen you function. That's one of the things in terms of the practice, the traditional practice, is you see how a person is and you know when you can trust them. You know, you see it. You see them function. You see them function through all kinds of stuff, emotional things that go on, loss, gain, all kinds of stuff. And then you see that their heart is focused on this consciousness, the pureness of consciousness, not a purity as in terms of moral content, but there is nothing written here. And then they can act from that in a way that benefits beings, you know, in whatever way, rather than becoming a thing called a teacher. If you think you're a teacher, start to think about the students and see how they learn. Because if you don't, you're superimposing a system on them. You've got to see how they function, how they develop and do something. If you think that you learn certain things intellectually and then you're done, no, it's nothing to do with intellect. Intellect at first gets in the way until you learn to use that as a tool rather than a collection of facts in your head. All that a collection of facts will do is will put you on the page. But then the functioning really needs the collective nature of consciousness, which then can be able to experience with people and work through things with people. Anyway, I think, you know, that will sort of cover the koan, I think, in itself. I've taken the page out, so I think we'll leave it at that. But always remember these things, is that Zen isn't a thing. It's if we want it to accommodate certain things and we want it to address certain things, we can do that. It's not that it's fixed in a certain way. A lot of people will say, well, Zen doesn't do this or Zen doesn't do that. Zen is not a thing. If it doesn't do that, it is you that needs to do it. And that's the thing, is that the practice of Zen will give you that independence to do, to take responsibility for, and to make any amends in that process from mistakes that you make. All right, I'd like to open up at that point to any questions or comments.
You're welcome to use the raise hand function at this time if you'd like to ask a question.
All right, Terry. You're on.
Morning.
Morning.
Okay, thank you. The term, the head and the tail, did this monk just come up with those terms, or is that something that was already being used in the...
I've no idea, but, you know, I mean, we can use analogies. You know, we invent analogies on the spot sometimes, you know. And it's that's one of the things is that with Cohen's study, one of the things it's designed to do is to take us away from cliche, so we look at things in a different perspective.
Okay. Right.
Yeah.
And then what was the master's name again?
Kyuho.
Kyuho. So Kyuho just picked right up on it because
he knew
the spirit of. The monk and,
yeah, it's
and,
play. It's play.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like when you were doing karate, I'm pretty sure if somebody brought something up in a certain way, you would run with that analogy in whatever way as far as you could. And analogies only will go a certain distance.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Or I bring up analogies depending on some students wouldn't understand it. You have to bring up some.
Yeah.
Another way.
Yeah.
To understand.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Anyo.
Whoops.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Great.
Good morning, everybody. And Roshi again. I want to go back to opening the eyes and not being aware of the dawn. Mm-hmm. Only I it could be that I was not listening well, to tell you the truth, but opening the eyes, I mean, using this head, that makes sense to me or speaks to me. But opening the eyes and not being aware of the dawn, does this speak to that lack of self, of the I'm conscious of being conscious?
Well, how would you say it? that's the cutting edge, you know. That's right there. I mean, he's doing the best he can with it, and you know, I can be critical of it, and I can say, well, you know, that's I would say differently, you know.
Yeah.
Which I would, you know, but the thing is. Does that resonate with your own experience? And that's the matching part of koan.
I guess how I would express it is maybe saying the dawn, the eyes completely filled with light.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I'm not going to say anything about that. You know, they'll leave that with you. Yeah, and then the thing is, you know, it's like we refine these things over our lifetime, you know, as well. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not really asking about enlightenment here. I'm really more asking about the expression of it. So you're answering that.
Yeah, I am. Uh-huh. Yeah. And that's more important that you do that, you know, because I do that naturally for myself, you know, so, yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Right, Liam, you're on.
Hi there. Good to be back. Just spent 3 weeks traversing my whole family. But, you know, being, it's kind of it's like that column is pretty, it just sort of fits over, you know, what I was, so I was away from, you know, my normal Sunday evening plugging into this. But, you know, and sometimes I feel I'm not really picking up much at all, but a lot of the time I do feel that. It's when I put it into practice. Oh no, it's not even putting it into practice.
Mm-hmm.
It's just me being me.
Yeah, yeah.
And then being. So I was like granddad to a 16-year-old, and took him shopping into Liverpool, and had a day out with him, and you know, it was just, you know, but it was just being. It was enjoyable.
Yeah.
And we had a good time. And another time I took my 11-year-old granddaughter out shopping. It was her birthday. And again, it was a completely different experience, but yeah, it's like just me.
Yeah.
You know, so I could feel that I'm far from perfect. I mean, you know, but I just felt that there was a little bit more of me being just naturally me rather than trying to be, you know, it was just a little bit more ease, right?
So yeah.
The head and the tail, just, you know, that put that into context was just a bit more balanced.
Mm-hmm. That's what the tail's there for.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So what I'm just saying, like, but it actually felt, you know, I know I survived the 40.3 degree, well, I don't know what that translates into Fahrenheit, about 120 or something, in London. I was there that day, and my little 9-year-old grandson wasn't in school because there was no air conditioning, and we spent the whole day in front of a big fan, you know.
Yeah.
But we were watching a thing called Outnumbered, which is about, you know, a family and a malfunctioning because the kids are just driving them crazy.
Yeah.
And both of us were just laughing, you know. So it was kind of a very balanced experience as well. Just the two of us having a good laugh.
Again, yeah.
You know. So anyway, it's going to be back. And I just like engaging as well because I think I feel that that's part of saying yes.
Yeah.
You know, saying that, right, I can do this. Because, you know, believe it or not, I'm actually quite a shy person, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
I always thought of
yeah. anyway. Yeah.
Maybe
definitely. Yeah.
Anyway, this is great.
Yeah. But, and remember, you know, also the head is a balance for the tail too.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a lovely poem from that point.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Just, yeah,
it sees both ends, and just, you know, and you can just be yourself and not worry too much.
Yeah,
about being anything else.
Yeah, and you know, there's a nice statement by Master Rinzai, who, you know, he said, so you want to escape the three worlds, which is, you know, a lot of people want to escape where they're at. You know, three worlds: past, present, and future. You know. Or it could be taken form, no form, desire. They'll say, so you want to escape that? He goes, well, then where will you go?
Yeah.
And this is the same thing, you know, is that if you can't really be yourself and then work with that, I don't mean your description of self. I mean, it's just how you be in that way. That's the core of the practice, is to swallow yourself whole with your warts and everything. You know,
and being where the Timothy Leary said, like, turn on, tune in, and drop out. Then years later, he said, like, there's nowhere to go. Drop out was turn on, tune in, and take over was a better expression for you.
Yeah,
but that was then.
That was then.
This is now. Thank you very much.
Apparently, he used to have a ranch in the next valley.
Really?
Oh,
wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Some goings on there, I'd say.
Yeah. But as they say, the mind boggles. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi.
Hey, Karen.
Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, yeah.
You can? Okay, good.
Yeah.
Hi. I'm in Lake Tahoe. I have on my Teletubby headphones, but that's why I have my video off.
Yeah.
But I liked what the last gentleman said.
Liam,
Liam, thank you. Yeah, about engaging.
Yeah.
I usually don't do that on here. I kind of just listen because I have so much to learn. But you said something that really did move me, and it was, I won't remember exactly, but paraphrasing, it was about connecting openly and not fearing, being fully engaged, there it is, being fully engaged means, I'm in my own words, like no boundaries. And so immediately when I thought that, I thought, oh yeah, that's really cool. And then it was absolute terror.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, now remember, this is important. You know, this entering into a situation openly, and then the boundaries are a tool. So you bring those boundaries in as necessary. Now, you've got your own way. Now, this is important. And you know your own pace. So the thing is, if you want to open up in certain ways, then practice that. And there's going to be contraction in that as part of the process. It doesn't mean, well, now, you know, I'm one with the universe and everything's going to work out. Is that, no, we get knocked down, then get back up, you know, over and over until we understand that there is openness there and those boundaries are a good tool to use every now and then. Yeah.
Yeah. So thank you for that. That was really, I guess, all I had to had to share. But right, quite an experience. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Hey, Jonan, you're on.
Hi.
Good seeing you.
I have headphones on too.
Yeah, good.
Nice to see you.
Yeah, you too. Yeah.
I hear about the thunderstorm. I want to take these off. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, yeah. Yeah. Just stay still for a minute. Oh, Bruce, what are you doing?
I was listening to your call on. The thing for me, like this morning, I wake up and my mind is going, and then I'm like, okay, I'm going to experience, you know, what's happening, and then. Never seems to work very well, and then I get kind of frustrated, and then real doubtful,
mm-hmm.
and then at some point it drops away, and then I realize that it's like, oh, there goes my mind again. It always wants to either do things or like fix things in a certain way, but the one that's functioning is always functioning.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And that's important. I mean, the first thing is, you know, look at the standards you're setting. Are they realistic? You know, where, like in the relative and absolute, it goes, do not judge by any standards, right? I mean, we have all kinds of standards, you know, so you can blow that one away to start off with, you know. But the thing is that we do have implicit standards that we don't bring out on the surface. You know, like, for instance, like... I would like, you know, I really want it to be this way. And then nothing matches that. It's like, you know, like somebody earlier was saying, being fully aware or totally aware. You know, what is that? Where's the gauge? You know, get some calipers, you know, and, you know, there's no gauge there. And so the thing is, it's the exploration that's the important thing and seeing if something's really realistic and coming back to, you know, for me, the world has always been this way ever since I was a little kid. It's not changed. So you know, why am I always looking for something else that is going to fill that space? You know, and then obviously in this process, it's not in the main, it's not just a matter of giving those things up. It's that after a while you wear them out, you know, simply by putting yourself or putting myself into this place. And then eventually a realization will come in. It's just like, I remember, why am I fighting with thought? Why am I doing that? It's pointless. And these things come up, and incrementally we get these insights into our own being, you know, And why am I always wanting something else? That's another one. You know, why do I want it to be another way? And that's that aspect of really, for a period of time, is just using that horrible word, discipline, to be here. And then in that process is that we learn what the mind, what the thinking mind likes to do. We learn about it. And so then it can be accommodated. It doesn't need to be fought with. But we're also understanding it, like you were saying, how the thought process works. And after a while is that I don't have to buy into that. Because in the main, it doesn't work. And, you know. So, you know, there's two processes. You know, there's one opening out to our environment and the people around us, and the second part is seeing how our own thought process works and our own sense sphere works. And in time is that then we can't be deluded that way. We just understand it. You know, every time I do this end, it ends up like this, you know. So you don't have to go there. Yeah, I mean, you know, and this beliefs, you know, it's just like when you went to AA, you had to have that trust that the belief that having a drink is going to cure everything. You got to examine that belief, and then after a while, you see it's not true. And we do that. We have narratives on many different levels of our own mind. You know, in fact, I am a thought addict. I know that. So the thing is not to put the trust in that. And knowing that I can't work out this world because it's too big.
Yeah. Yeah, and also dropping that idea of who I think I am. Things I think I should be. And then becoming friends with the actual person that I am.
Yeah.
It's when that happens, it's quite a relief.
Yeah. Actually. Yeah.
Not so bad.
No. Well, thanks for that, Bruce.
Thank you.
Right, Sheila, you're on.
Thank you, Roshi. Thank you for the talk.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Could I just come back to this, the first part of the current, opening the eyes and not being aware of the dawn?
Yeah.
I'm not getting anything from that. I wonder if you could just say a bit more.
I think it'd be dangerous. I think it'd be dangerous to say more. You know, in other words, you know, the thing is that it's not an objective realization that we can judge, you know, this, and you know, at the time of dawn, being awake and aware, there's no criteria around it.
I think.
Or, you know, you could say, you know, something like, shop's open, but there's nobody home. And we recognize it to a certain degree is that before thought arises, it's like this. Whether we think or not, it's like this.
Yeah.
Whether I'm good, bad, or indifferent, it is like this. You know, rather than following the criteria, is this awakening? Is this objective? No. It's that comes in and hits you like a ton of bricks. That is far more important. And that's what helps is that when you go into a very difficult meeting with somebody, you can accommodate that person that's there and be that and have that more that sense of the common good rather than immediately putting up the barriers. And then an outcome can come out of it rather than no outcome or a negative outcome.
So the dawn is not something fixed.
No, it could be nighttime, could be lunchtime, doesn't matter.
Or the realization isn't a dawning as such.
Well, it can be. It can be a new start. For many people, it's a new start, you know. Now, in doing this, in internalizing it, don't analyze the words too much. Just put it in and get that feeling. Because, you know, quite often these koans also act like cognitive stops. You can't think them out. You got to be that experience. And then even sitting with that for a while will change the way that you think. That's one of the ways that koan work. You know, because usually we just let the mind run down set channels that we're used to doing. But koans don't allow you to do that. You've got to sit in a more open an open space. So then it begins to break down the ways that we habitually think.
Okay.
Thank you. Hey, Galen.
Morning. So I was kind of intrigued when you were commenting on the statement, well, after all, it's not precious. And you said, how can that be?
Yeah.
You know, because so often when we begin a practice like this, or at some point, that notion of opening our eyes is really a precious kind of thing. But it struck me this morning that you had, that, you know, it's like the most common thing ever since all beings.
Yeah.
Have, you know, and it reminded me of water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the most common thing on earth probably is water, isn't it, I guess? You know?
Yeah, close and enough.
So it's just everywhere, but until it's not, and when it's not, suddenly it's very precious, you know? Mm-hmm. It's a, I guess it never is not, and the analogy only goes so far, but, you know, that's where I started reacting to you going, now, how can you say that?
Because
you know,
I did. Well, you know, the thing is, the thing is, usually with practices that people take it precious for a while because it's new, not to have uninterrupted thought running. Okay, so then people begin to go, well, I can only do this in meditation. You know, but if you've got a good teacher, they won't let that happen. They give you all kinds of circumstances to work in. And, you know, usually the better ones are difficult. It's like Maizumi Roshi said to me, he goes, you know, I was going through a hard time, and he goes, it's not my job to make it easy for you. You know, my job is to throw concrete blocks in front of you. You know, and that's the way I see it, is that if I made it easy for here, the people would be weak. No, I'm serious. What could they do out in the world? And most of them leave and go out in the world. If they don't have that strength, then what am I doing? You know, there's another story like that. There was, you know, we had a neighbor deer that has gone missing, and they sent some detectives over. And one of them is asking, well, what do you do here? Do you do like stress reduction? I say, no, I give them more stress so they become better at dealing with it. You know, and that's the thing, is that with Zen, it's a different thing. It's not just holding on to states of mind. A lot of people think it's holding on to states of mind. No. How am I in the midst of anger? How am I in the midst of sadness? How am I in the midst of the human condition? Can I do it so that there is no damage there? And that's where the work is. It's wherever I find myself, practice appears. And that's the not precious, is there's an opportunity every single moment. It's not about being in places, etc. So in time is the, you know, you've heard those nice words like choiceless awareness. You know, is that this is what's going on, so this is what I deal with. So better to choose what's there. And it's not about preciously holding on to states of mind, which is obviously a disease of Zen too. But, you know, each one of us is different in whatever way, you know. We all have our own karma or ways that we've lived within circumstances that have developed us as human beings. And so I can't really be critical of somebody else if I haven't stood in their shoes or had their background. But I can learn from them in whatever way. And that's the beauty of pure consciousness, is that if you look at something for long enough, you're going to see what it is. Yeah, well, you know, I've got to sell cars, you know, obviously. Yeah. Right, Terry, you're back on.
Yeah, thank you, Roshi. Just dawned on me, pun intended.
Yeah.
That when I, you know, thinking about my tail, when I function, that I tend to make that the same as, or think of it as trying to accomplish something, but that's not necessarily true, is it?
No, well, you know, the thing is, you accomplish no matter what. You accomplish a mess. Right. You know, the important thing is doing,
good.
You know, is doing the best that you can with whatever's in front of you. It's not just about success. I mean, I just look at the things that I've so-called failed at, you know, and it's irrelevant. The thing is putting the energy in there, and then that energy can always be put into something else. But, you know, is like sometimes I'll enter into something knowing it's going to be a failure.
But learning experience.
Exactly, for the people that are around me. It doesn't have to always work out. You know, but we have to watch out for that mindset that we have as human beings. Remember, one guy really appreciated, you know, the way that we ran things. So he gave us all this expensive machinery, and then the floods hit us, and then so it's just like that. Oh, you know, you guys are no good because, you know, your karma isn't good. You know, and it's just like, and it's bullshit. You know, I mean, I really didn't care about the machines. I gave them in back. You know, there's no problem with that. But the thing is, what are our criteria that run underneath? Those are the things that run us, you know, those subroutines, basically. And that's a big part of meditation. We begin to see those things. And after a while is that, no, those are not true. Those things aren't true to you know, the context of this moment in time.
Yeah, if I accomplish failure, then a good lesson, and I don't give up. I mean, I just, you know, functioning doesn't mean only success.
Right, right.
If it did, then I would have given up a long time ago.
Yeah. You know, the thing about failure is you learn about what works and what doesn't work. With success, you just learn about what works.
Yeah,
I remember there was a potter that came here that was it was like a Native American potter, and he was talking with I can't remember his name now, the guy that used to live here who sold us the property, Tom Fresh, that's right, and he said he did this firing of 2 weeks work. Of making pots, and he did this firing, all of the pots broke.
Wow.
You know, and he just went, this is what happens sometimes. And I really appreciate it. You know, obviously he wasn't like, oh, duh, I'll do the same thing again. It's he learned from it. And this also was a person that recreated a northern northern Mexican pottery that had been lost for 500 years. And there was a lot of trial and error in that. You know, when you look at it, that's what life is that we don't come with a manual. I didn't, you know. Look what happened.
No.
You know.
That's part of training.
Yeah, exactly. So how is it meant to turn out? You know, that's a question.
Whatever.
Yeah. Well, that's a good answer. Whatever. Yeah.
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 Okay, thank you.
Thank you.